Welcome to the Oxford NC Exchange, a podcast dedicated to providing Oxford-related media for Oxford, North Carolina. In this episode, Adam and Alan interview Mark Pace, specialist for the North Carolina Room for the Granville County Library System and resident expert historian of Oxford, North Carolina. We want to welcome everyone once again to the Oxford NC Exchange, the podcast of Oxford, North Carolina. Oxford Media for Oxford people. Today we have the pleasure of hosting local historian and all sorts of artistic abilities, our own Mark Pace. Mark, we're grateful for you taking the time.
Well, thanks for the opportunity.
Yes. Welcome to the Oxford NC Exchange. Three questions that we always like to ask people that are on the exchange. Who are you? What brings you to Oxford? What is your absolute favorite thing to do here? And what is the best thing that has happened to you in Oxford? Take those in any order that you want.
Well, my name is Mark Anthony Pace. I'm the North Carolina Room Specialist at the Richard H. Thornton Library. I've been doing that since 2009. For lack of a better term, I'll say I run the North Carolina Room. It's a local genealogical and local history library. And it's basically... It's where the history of Granville County is in a more of a paper sense, rather than the museum, which is more deals more with artifacts, and this deals more with archives.
Right.
What's my favorite thing to do in Oxford? Actually, to be kind of doing what I'm doing today. I like to get out in the community, talk to civic groups, to promote history. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that one of my favorite things is on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon is to find a cemetery that nobody's been to before and go down there and crawl in the woods and take pictures and enumerate who's buried there, things like that.
Right.
What's the best thing that's happened to me in Oxford? I will say this unequivocally. It's moving to Oxford. I took that job as part-time. It was a part-time job in 2009. I was living in Raleigh, and I had my own advertising firm. I was freelance, and I was an illustrator and a designer, creative design. And I took that job as a part-time job. It was 3 days a week. I commuted up here, and eventually it became a full-time position. And in 2012, I actually moved to Oxford. And I really didn't realize how much I disliked living in Raleigh until I moved to Oxford. I was born in a small town. My family has lived in Henderson for 250 years plus. I am not a big city person. Mayberry is fine with me.
Right.
And the one thing I always liked, I disliked the impersonality of a large city like Raleigh, and the fact that it was the growth and the aesthetic of it seemed out of control and not very well planned. And it was, you know, Raleigh has grown multiple times in my
yes.
lifetime from what I remember when I was a kid. So when I came to Oxford, I liked the people. I liked the slow pace of the place. I liked the people here. It has been the best thing that I've done in my adult life was moving to Oxford. I wish I had done it 40 years ago. Mm. And I'm not to say that I don't like Henderson either, but there's something about Oxford that's a little different than most towns in North Carolina, Piedmont, North Carolina, that is its size. There's a group of people who really care about the community. I don't know if it's a legacy of all the colleges and private schools that were here, but people in Oxford, they have a certain sense of history and academia, and they have a certain aesthetic sense. I mean, you're going to meet people from all socioeconomic backgrounds here, but it does seem like people in Oxford, they've just got a little... I'll put it to you this way. Oxford was described in its day as the Athens of the South. I don't know if you've ever heard that term because there were so many colleges and schools here. And I thought, well, growing up in Henderson was a mill town, a cotton mill town. Oxford is a tobacco town. There's a difference, there was a difference back in the day. And I thought, if Oxford is Athens, then I grew up in Sparta. So truly the best thing about Oxford moving here has been whatever I do for the rest of my life, I foresee that I will be here till the day I pass.
Right. Right.
So you said, what is your exact title and role as it pertains to the Granville County Library system.
Yeah, my actual title is North Carolina Room Specialist, which is my primary responsibility there. It's the maintenance of the North Carolina Room, which, as I've mentioned, was primarily a genealogical library. We have about 6,500 books in there, and we have vertical files, and we do have some artifacts and some manuscripts. We have some family Bibles. Specifically, my job is to make sure the materials in there are pertinent to Granville County or the surrounding area, counties that are contiguous with Granville County, and that includes Southside Virginia. A good example would be I try to maintain a collection of annuals, school annuals. And we've talked about
that, Adam. Yeah, I've been there for that, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, and we have school annuals back to the late 1920s from Granville County. Things like phone books. I mean, you might not think of phone books as being a genealogical or historical resource, but we have phone books. We have the Oxford phone book from 1903. And there will be times when people need that, and I can tell you a story about that later, but that's primarily my function there. Of course, I'm also work at the library, which means I help try to facilitate people who come into the library and Patriots and what they want to find, whether they're trying to use a computer or get their tax forms or fax something. Or it's funny, the library is kind of the court of last resort on a lot of inquiries. You wouldn't believe some of the questions I get asked sometimes, like, you know, I've had people ask me all sorts of things like, you know, my rheumatism is bothering me on this left leg, you know, and I was like, well, that might be a question for a doctor. Well, can you get me a doctor that I can talk to? You know, we always have a saying at the library, we provide tax forms for people.
Right.
But as you know, there's a fine line between giving somebody tax forms and doing their taxes for them, because people will let you do as much for them as you are willing to do.
Yes.
And sometimes, and this happens in the North Carolina room too, somebody will want to get on Ancestry.com or be looking for a will or a deed, and you can explain it to them, but then it might be you take less time if you just go ahead and pull that deed.
Right.
Or rather than give them a treatise on how to use a computer, you just get on Ancestry and find what they're looking for them in like 2 minutes rather than them taking half an hour to do it. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, and in the North Carolina room, what kind of collections and records do you have there? You said you have things like the annuals and
I just alluded to that. We have a few things that I had goals for the North Carolina room when I started there. I wanted to increase our African American collection because African American history is something that was neglected for a long time, and then we're in a period now where there's more of an appreciation for it. African Americans and people with African American heritage are more interested in history than in any other time.
Yeah,
that's something I focused on. Virginia, records from Virginia. Prior to the Civil War, about 95% of the people that come from Granville County come from Virginia. So I've really tried to increase that collection. I mentioned the annuals. I mentioned the phone books. One of my goals is to have a history of every church in Granville County. Most churches have some sort of history. They've either published or they have records. That's one. I see the North Carolina room sometimes as a court of last resort for family records and people that the continuity of Oxford, a place like Oxford, has kind of been broken in the last 20 to 30 years. In other words, you had people that would live here 3 or 4 or 5 generations, but now people move away. Other people move here from other places.
Right.
Granville County's segueing into being more of a suburban area. So a lot of times I have people that will be cleaning out mom and dad's house. They've passed on or they've gone to a rest home, and they find things in there. And like, we don't want to throw this away, but this is an old family Bible. Or these are some letters my great-grandfather wrote when he was in World War I.
Right.
We hate to throw those out. Is there a place for it? And this is where our real value is in the North Carolina room. A place like UNC or Duke or their manuscripts collection North Carolina State Archives, they are interested in things like that, but maybe on a broader statewide sense. In other words, a family history in Oxford, North Carolina, or somebody lived in Stovall or wherever, they're not really interested in that. That's not their purpose. They're interested in more broader records, I would say. So that's where we come in because, I mean, this history gets lost every time you clean out a house and you throw the stuff away.
Right.
I'll give you a classic example. You were talking, Adam, you talked about the annuals. We had a family that were cleaning out their their family's house, and this particular person had been a teacher here in Granville County from the mid-50s to the mid-90s.
Right.
And they had cleaned up everything out of the house, and they had a stack of annuals about this high.
Really?
And they said, well, wait, right, nobody wants these. We'll throw these. No, 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 let's run by a library and see if Mark's interested in them. Huh. And it was a gold mine because, I mean, I got Oxford annuals from 1955 to 1962 and then Webb from 63 to 95.
Wow. Nice.
I mean, you know, and you cannot go out to a bookstore and buy something like that. They don't even right. sell them online on eBay. You know, so, I mean, that's where those are the collections that we have. We have vertical files, too, and we have individual family histories. But that's kind of an overview. And, of course, we also have a electronic or digital component, too, which is that, you know, we have the capability, if you don't have a subscription to Ancestry.com, a family search, or something like Fold 3, which has military records, you can come to the library and come to the North Carolina room. We even have an old-timey microfiche reader, which I'm not talking about microfilm with the reels, but these were those little things
Yes.
You won't remember it.
Yeah.
But you probably do.
I remember that from high school,
yes. The plastic sheets about like that. Well, apparently we have the only one within a several county radius because every now and then they say, Mark, why do you keep that antiquated thing? That thing is from the 70s.
Right.
I said, no, it's not going anywhere. We'll have somebody come in and they'll have their military records, you know, from Vietnam or something like that, were actually on microfiche.
Really?
And, you know, so those are some of the things that would kind of, that would certainly be described as niches.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
But those are some of the things that, are the collections and records that we have in there.
Huh. I find that fascinating, you know, in the way that you've just described that and the changing demographic.
Yes.
You mentioned, okay, there was history that was preserved simply because of continuity of residence.
That is
over
true.
Over generations.
That's true, yeah.
And now entering more and more a world where people come and go. They might be here for a generation or two and move on. The kids are born here. They move away.
Think of how many people graduate from college and then move to a different state for a job.
Yes.
Think of how many people that work here in Granville County and work in Granville County government that don't live here. They live in Raleigh or they live in Henderson or they live somewhere else.
Yeah.
You have to go where the job is, so to speak. And it breaks that continuity. The other aspect of that I did want to bring up, too, there was a time when there was an old established kind of people in the community that had had families that had run things for generation after generation. You've run into it, I'm sure, here at the church. And they were the ones that preserved the records, their history, their family, so on and so forth. And as things changed, their prominence is not what it used to be. So there are now people that were not interested in genealogy and history, say, two or three generations ago.
Right.
People that were maybe from the poor end of the socioeconomic scale, or African Americans, or women, or people that, you know, that just were not interested in that history because they weren't part of it.
Right.
And that's changed.
Hmm.
That's changed, I think. So, and then there's also the general thing going on in the country now, which is the perceptions of what history is, and, you know, we alluded to it a little bit earlier, but I mean, you know, history undergoes a lot of revisionism now. It's a lot different than when we were kids, and there were certain things that were accepted and, you know, certain roles of people that were given, and, you know, some of the founding fathers and people like that have come in for a great deal of revisionism, but it's a whole idea of people kind of looking for a specific history that they weren't before.
Right, right. Yeah.
Can you tell us more? Did you have something, Alan?
Oh, I was just going to make the comment, you know, and I'm just saying this as somebody in the business is, you know, so much of history, especially biblical history, is one that is, okay, we're just in the same area telling the stories over and over and over again, that sort of continuity. And it's like, well, where does the Bible come from? It comes from, oh, that continuity gets disrupted. And then it's like, the Bible's kind of like a historical room.
It's funny you would say that because I always, in growing up, always was interested in it as more of a historical document than I was. Of course, you get older, you start thinking about things more than you did when you were a kid. So, I mean, there's a certain philosophical and theological aspect of it that I pay more attention to. But I always saw it first and foremost as a history.
It is.
Numbers.
Yes.
It's nothing but a chapter on genealogy.
It is.
I mean,
it is.
It's genealogy, the basic genealogy going all the way back.
Yes. You know? When you go through the story of origins, through the book of Genesis, and almost half of the book is... Oh, well, so-and-so begat so-and-so, begat so-and-so. They lived to, 940 years old or whatever.
Whatever, Methuselah,
It's like saying, okay, this was their phone book. These were records. If the Bible is a noble thing, then most certainly,
But isn't it interesting that as time goes on, how it's reinterpreted and there's not as much of a wholesale and general opinion about things as there used to be?
What do you mean by that?
I mean by that is there was a time when people would say, well, it's in the Bible. Everybody accepted it as it was written. And now that interpretation of it might be slightly redone according to what somebody's personal beliefs are on a certain subject or a certain cultural subject that would be... very topical right now.
Yeah, we are permitted way more suspicion these days.
Well, and that is true, and that applies to history.
I'm not saying that's a bad thing.
But it applies to history. What you find out is you find out your heroes from the past, for instance, or events in the past were not as cut and dry. World War II was not right and wrong. There were nuances there.
Yeah.
The American Civil War was not what you might have been thought it was fought about, so on and so forth. Those are some examples.
Right. I'm curious, in thinking about, the role that, the North Carolina genealogy room at the library plays, what do you want it to be able to do for Oxford, North Carolina?
Okay. I've been accused of just kind of sitting something out. I look at it like this. It is not my role to get involved in whatever agenda you may have that you're looking to prove through history for whatever purpose.
Yeah.
My purpose there is to provide the basic information to you, and I have my opinion on certain things, like the American Civil War, the Second World War, race relations, or whatever. I'm not there to espouse those opinions. I'm there to provide you with the raw data that you can take and interpret it and use as you want.
Right.
Now, you were asking about, your question was what, I kind of got off the topic of the
question.
Well,
we have a resource here.
Yes.
A good resource.
We got a really good resource. It's unique almost. There are only three or four other libraries. It's not unique, but there are three or four other libraries in North Carolina. One in Salisbury, the Kellenberger Library, and New Bern, the Heritage Center in Smithfield being some examples. That are able to disseminate that history and that have the support of the community, that there's a facility and that there's a conscious interest to promote that history. Having said that, the one thing about Oxford and Granville County in particular is it is such a unique history and it is so atypical of the rest of the surrounding area. Case in point, in 1860, Granville County had more enslaved people living here in Granville County than another county in North Carolina. The plantation system developed to a degree here that it never did in other places in North Carolina. The list goes on. Camp Butner, just did a program on Camp Butner the other day. We had a military base here that had 35,000 people living in it. Yeah. Not every community can say that. Yeah. Not every community can say for its size that we have two orphanages here.
Right.
We have had four colleges here. The only place in North Carolina practically, if you were African American in Jim Crow era, to get an high school education was in Oxford, North Carolina. James E. Webb, the people that have come through here, other people, George Clayton Shaw, Henry Plumbaccini. Every community has their museum and they're proud of their history. But
right.
I am telling y'all, Oxford and Granville County, in all of Granville County, is just different. That the best tobacco that was ever grown on the planet Earth in the late 1800s was grown here. I mean, the list of unique things about this place goes on and on and on and on.
I heard there was also a horse that was back in the 1800s, wasn't it?
Sir Archie?
Yeah.
The most famous horse in practically every Preakness, Belmont Stakes, and Kentucky Derby winner is descended from Sir Archie. Sir Archie was the greatest horse of the 18th of the 1800s.
Huh.
And I mean, he won six races, and after that, nobody would race with him. So then he sired out. And as a matter of fact, it's kind of interesting. Over when he was over in Northampton County, when you go into Northampton County, on the mural, they don't have the famous people from there. There's a giant picture of Sir Archie on there.
Wow.
I guess if you're a Chamber of Commerce, you hang your hat on whatever you can. But,
right.
But, I mean, that's a good example of what I'm talking about, Adam. That's an excellent example. Yeah.
You've already alluded to a lot of it, but can you tell us more about the history of Oxford in general and Granville County?
Well, I've alluded to it. Granville County, just keep this in mind, some basic things to keep in mind. Granville County is a mother county. It was formed in 1746. When I say mother county, several other counties, current Granville County, parts of Person County, Vance County, Franklin County, and Warren County come out of this
Granville county. Of the
division over time. I got a call from somebody one time and years ago, and they said, I'm so confused. Because my ancestors lived there, and they moved all the time. I said, what do you mean? Well, said, first they were in Granville County, then they moved to Butte County, then they moved to Franklin County, then they moved to Vance County. I said, no, they didn't move. The borders get moved.
Huh.
That's something basic to keep in about, you know, as a starting point for history here. Of course, any discussion about history in this area is going to revolve around two things, and that's race relations and tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
And tobacco was predominant until probably the early 1970s. Of course, that dynamic economically has changed.
Right.
Demographically, it's interesting. Granville County, after the American Civil War, Granville County was majority African American, 65 to about 35%.
Right.
And they were Republican. And that dynamic's changed. Of course, now it's almost demographically that figure has been reversed.
There, right.
The percentage of the population here that's African American is about 35%.
Right.
But anyway, those are just some basic things to keep in mind about this area. It has changed more in the last 30 years probably than in the previous 250 years.
Really? Say more about that.
Well, I mean, you know, it's gone from being an agriculturally based community and a monoculture. And it's not just agriculturally based, but there's only one crop and everything was tobacco.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody made it. And the economic system has changed. At one point by the 1930s, about 70% of the people in Granville County were engaged in sharecropping, which I've always equated to being an economic form of slavery, to be honest with you, because it's a cycle you can never break out of.
Yeah.
And that dynamic has changed with the growth of Raleigh and Durham and Chapel Hill. Of course, the area has become more associated with the suburban demographic. That's changed. We're more diversified economically from an industrial base. I mean, there's several different... I mean, look, if something happens at Bandag or Revlon, it affects the local economy.
Yeah.
One of the issues with my hometown is there were the cotton mills, there was J.P. Taylor, and there was Rose's. And all three of those had economic difficulties or went out of business. So the diversity of the economy is another thing that's changed significantly, and the people that moved here that are here from other places now. You guys, I mean, where were your ancestors from?
Mostly here, and then Texas.
Okay. Yours were Colorado, right?
No. Before that, I started out in Florida. both of my folks are from Minnesota. Really.
Okay. Well, I'm just to illustrate the point, that's an aspect of things that are changed because people have moved here from other places.
Yeah.
And I don't really have a... I think that's a wonderful thing because it adds diversity, it adds kind of an energy to the place that you might not see in some surrounding places like that.
Right. My question, in light of what you just said is, okay, how does a new population learn the history of the place that it now lives?
And it's important that they do that.
Yeah.
It's important, quite frankly, there's an economic aspect of it. Granville County has a history that other places don't have. It's not a primary thing that attracts people here. I mean, good school systems and jobs do that.
Yeah.
But it's also a factor. I mean, I try to point out at the North Carolina Room to the powers that be that, you know, people come here. About 40% of the people that come and use the North Carolina Room are not from this county. They're here had people come as far away as California and London.
Yeah.
But getting back to your point, though, it is an important part of the community, and it's something that I think adds to it, maybe not economically so much as it does culturally and socially.
Right.
You know, and that's my job. I mean, to do podcasts and do programs and all to promote that history, because that's a resource we have here that we need to take advantage of.
Right. To what degree do the schools here, you know, make use of the room, of the library, of the resources that are there? You know, for, you know, kids and teachers knowing.
I do have a lot of participation from some of the local schools. Like in a couple of weeks, I'm going to be taking a senior class and doing a 3-hour walking tour of the history of downtown Oxford. I find, matter of fact, the John Penn thing, that was all motivated originally by a group of people that thought that John Penn, in my character, I play John right. Penn in character, and to go, that the motivation for that was to go talk to the school kids. It right. turned into more than that, of course.
Yeah.
But they've been very cooperative. I will say this, and when I grew up, I mean, I loved history, and it was presented in a way, you know, I just think it was just the way it was. Sometimes history class can take the most interesting and wonderful history and turn it into something really, really tedious and boring.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like all those English, those classics I was supposed to read in high school, and I finally got around to reading them in my 20s and 30s and thought, wow, all right, this Huckleberry Finn is an interesting book.
Yes.
I mean, you know, that sort of thing. It's a little bit like that, but I mean, you know, they do the best they can do with what they have.
Yeah.
You know? But I would say, all in all, that is something that there's more of a consciousness of than there was before.
Right.
Particularly, like I said, particularly in the African-American community, with the advent of Black Lives Matter, there's been a renewed interest by young African-Americans and other folks in the local history, too.
I'm curious, you know, after you've said that, what has been the impact of technology and access on the discipline of history?
It has changed. It's been revolutionary from a genealogical and local history point of view. When I started this in 1976, I was in high school. If I wanted to look up a census record, I had to take half a day off, drive to Raleigh, park, go to state archives, get out the Soundex microfilm reel, go through that. That took about an hour, and then I'd get the original microfilm of, say, the 1900 census, go through that, scroll through that. And after half a day, I would find out that my grandfather lived in Epsom, North Carolina in 1900, okay, and how old he was, and I found the information. You can do that now in 30 seconds.
Hmm.
And so that has changed. Things like DNA, for instance, nobody in their right mind would have conceived 30 years ago that you could find out who a first cousin was or a second cousin or whatever, or what their ethnic makeup was from something like DNA. I'm still not convinced that if things keep progressing the way they are, there might come a day when they won't need a genealogist or a local history person, because it'll all be online, and then they'll be able to, some formula or some technology will come along that will enable them to find out what I get paid to find out for them. So. But no, it's been revolutionary. I can think about things. Of course, Ancestry.com comes to mind. A family search, a lot of, even Granville County now, a lot of courthouse records are now online. Granville County has all their deeds all the way back to 1746. You don't have to drive from Maryland to come here to go spend half a day in the basement of the courthouse. That's
right.
Been revolutionary. Some other aspects, one of my favorite things is newspapers.com, which is we have access to. And this is a database of all the newspapers. And what's nice about it is you can OCR. It has optical character recognition. I'll give you a good example personally. I always heard my great-great-grandfather, Benjamin Franklin Askew, was a hypochondriac. That's what we always heard in our family. That's just stories you hear, right?
Right.
So when we got newspapers.com, I typed in B.F. Askew, Benjamin Franklin Askew, all sorts of things on it. And come to find out in 1903 in the Franklinton Times, no, it was the Franklin Times, out of Lewisburg, there was a testimonial for this elixir that some snake oil salesman was selling.
Right.
You know, and it promised all sorts of things. It got rid of headaches. One of them, it said it was, it got rid of indiscretions of youth or diseases that you might have accrued during indiscretions of youth.
Right, yes.
Another one was female complaints. I don't know. I'm still not sure what that was. All sorts of things. Stomach cramps, headaches, all the rest of it. And one of the testimonials was from a man named Benjamin Franklin Askew in Epsom, North Carolina, and said it had cured his stomach aches, his headaches, his rheumatism, and he would swear by it.
Really?
And I thought he was either very, very sick or He was a hypochondriac, as we had heard. That's just an example about,
right.
You know, I would have never found that if it had the technology hadn't come along for that. It's been revolutionary. And it's been good and it's been bad because, let's face it, you know, just because it's on the internet doesn't mean it's true. And a lot of times information is posted by people on the internet with regards to genealogy and history that's not necessarily correct. There's a quote by Winston Churchill that I love that says that he used to say that a lie is halfway around the world by the time the truth gets up and puts their shoes on.
I was going to say it's probably less time than that.
It's probably less time than that now.
Nanosecond.
There's a downside to it, but I think all in all, the effect has been more than positive.
Right. Right.
And it could put me out of business one day, as I said, but that's okay as long as people get the information.
What do you think, what does the historian have to do to authenticate the things that they say in this era? You know, given that, okay, anything can be put out on the internet. I remember seeing something a few years ago, you know, that was, you know, one of the problems with the internet these days is that you can put anything out it, you know, and it was, you know, a quote from Abraham Lincoln.
Okay, I got you. I would say this, and we really try, the core group of people that come in and do a lot of research, they've been doing research for years like me, people in the Historical Society and Genealogy Society, we have to always say we have to be more diligent than ever because, like you said, I always tell people, come, if you see it on the internet, that's fine. Or you say you've got an abstract that somebody typed up about a will from your great-granddaddy. Look at the will. Look at the original will. If at all possible, look at those primary and original source documents, okay? Don't just assume something, you know? And the irony is, here in this era where more information is available and at your fingertips than in any other time in human history, ironically enough, you have to be more diligent now to find the truth than in any other time, I think, my personal opinion.
Yeah.
You know, you really have to, like I said, because if we discussed it, there's probably an answer out there. If you think there's an answer that you want to hear, somebody will provide that with you, but it might not necessarily be the truth.
You know? Right.
And that's documented. I say there should be a law that if you publish a genealogy book, there's two things that should be in it. An index, which is not always the case, and to document every statement that's in there. One of the things, I'll give you a good example. I had another ancestor named Jonathan Franklin Steinbeck. They were both of these gentlemen were from Franklin County, by the way. And I'd always seen his name as Jonathan F. Steinbeck. And I thought, well, somebody found out what his middle name was, okay? Because he died in, 1912. And I looked at the internet, and they got it from another source, who got it from another source, who got it from another source. And then finally I traced it back to a Facebook page, and somebody just had assumed that if he was from Franklin County and his middle initial was F, then it was Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I found out later on from a Bible record, I found his middle name was Fawn, F-A-W-N.
Hmm.
Okay. But what I'm saying to you, following that chain back, it just gave me more and more and more inaccurately documented information, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
And so, you know, there's hundreds, if not thousands of cases, if not millions of cases like that where that's you don't want to assume anything. You don't want to assume anything. I've seen some of the strangest things before in genealogy. I have seen two people with the same name marry two people with the same name. I mean, you know, particularly if you got a name here, like in Granville County, if their name is John Bullock or James Curran or
a lot of
William Watkins, or the ones that I always love are like William Williams and Daniel Daniels and things like that. I mean, you run into stuff like that. So you have to be diligent.
I guess it is nice not to have to change your last name, though, if you don't want to.
Oh, yeah. It's the worst one. One of the craziest ones I ever saw was there was a Johnson married a Johnson in Johnston County. Johnson's a fairly common last name. It's not outrageous, you know. And then, of course, what you run into sometimes here, like here, John Bullock had a son named William Bullock. William Bullock named his son John Bullock. John Bullock named his son William Bullock. Philemon Hawkins had three sons, John, William, and Philemon Jr. And each of the three sons had three sons and named each of their three sons John, Philemon, and William. I mean, you know, and it just, it's so, you know, did you hear that Philemon Hawkins died the other day? Who told you? Philemon Hawkins. I mean, you know, that's, you get into things like that. You know, young Philemon Hawkins, not Philemon, right. Philemon Hawkins Jr. But now that Philemon Hawkins Sr.'s died, now from now on he's going to be Philemon Hawkins Sr. because he's got a son named Philemon, and Philemon III is now Philemon Jr. You see where I'm going with all of this.
Yes.
Well, is that actually how it works?
And actually, everything I just told you was true, Adam.
Oh, wow.
Sure, you really, it really is. I've seen
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I've seen that. And then you get the things like, and I don't want to get too far off top of your question, though, but there's a family out of Warren County called Somerville. To date, I've seen that name spelled 14 different ways. S-U-M-S-O-M-V-I-L-V-E-L, so on and so forth.
Right.
And then you get Ann Eliza Somerville and Annie Liza Somerville, and it just goes on and on and on.
There's a road in the southern part of the county that goes between Stem and Creemore, and it has four names, and I always enjoyed that.
Oh, how about...
It's called Stem, Maine, Brogdon, and Creemore.
Yeah, and not only that, how many... There's Little Mountain, Mountain Creek.
Right, yeah.
There's about four different mountains up there, too. And then there's about three different roads in the northern part of the county named Hart. I know that.
Yeah, and my sister was trying to get to the back roads one time to get to our house, and she was going to take Range Road near Butner.
Oh, and that's a complete circle.
And Range touches two different places on Old 75.
So. I found that out because if you follow Range, you'll go all the way back around to where you started, pretty much. And then the other way, heck, what am I talking about? Here in Oxford, we have College Street, New College Street, and then there's College Street.
And we have Forest Road, Forest Avenue.
Somewhere in there, Hillsboro becomes Williamsboro.
But which has always been a really interesting thing because in the short distance at the middle of town, if you're on the right-hand lane, it's Williamsboro Street till you get to College Street.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
If you're on the other side of the road, it's Hillsboro Street till you get to Main Street.
Get to Main, yeah.
So you've actually, I don't know if it's still that way, but when I first moved here it was. So you've actually got a situation where for a one block, it's Williamsboro and Hillsboro Street, depending on which side of the road you're on.
I did not know that.
So. Yeah, and if you keep going down College into downtown, you get to Bank Street. And then that's parallel to Wall Street. And, you know, everyone always talks about great, you know, talks about New York City or whatever. But we got a Wall Street here in Oxford, so.
I know, because I always tell people, see, Wall Street runs by the library. It comes back by the library. Our address is Main Street. But people ask me, so where are you these days? I'm working on Wall Street.
You know, it's almost as if, you know, Granville County wanted to provide challenges for future historians.
I swear, you are not the first person that says that. I'll give you a good example. Here's one more to confirm that. When they started the will books and deed books in Granville County in 1746, they were listed alphabetically. Will Book A, Will Book B.
Mm-hmm.
All right, this rolled along till about 1810, 1820, and guess what happened? They ran out of letters of the alphabet. So what do? They start with Will Book 1. And then they go 2, 3, and 4, and so on. And somebody will say, well, okay, should I look in Will Book 1? That's in 1746. I said, no, Will Book 1 is like 1810. Mm. I mean, you know, and that really throws people off. But And we always said, didn't the clerk of court and the register of deeds in 1746, did it ever occur to them that Granville County might last long enough to use up all the letters in the alphabet? Well, did they do that deliberately to kind of mess with us?
Yeah.
Right. It's like now we have Gen Z and now the next one is Generation Alpha.
Yeah.
So we're using the Greek letters now.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't even thought about that. But what do I care? I'm a baby boomer.
Right. I know you mentioned the guy earlier, but who was John Penn? And what was the significance to the founding of America in this area?
Okay, John Penn was one of the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence. And as I've mentioned earlier, I do kind of have a period costume, and I do John Penn in character. Granville County, again, is very unique and fortunate. There's not too many places in America that can say that they had a signer of the Declaration of Independence that lived here and was buried here.
Right.
He moved here in 1774. Now, I will tell you straight up, the guy who was really running things here in the 1700s, and particularly during the Revolution, was a man named General Thomas Person. But he was a guy who liked to work from the background. So he would get his friends to run for political office and then tell them what to do.
Right.
And, of course, later on, Person County is named for him.
Yeah.
He was also the wealthiest man in Granville County. He, at one point, owned about 85,000 acres.
Wow.
Just phenomenal. John Penn was in the right, and John Penn has said this in some of his letters and the remarks, that he was simply in the right place at the right time. He was elected from North Carolina with two other representatives from North Carolina. He was from the interior. He was more from what the time was, this was the frontier. He was more of a rough and tumble kind of guy. He was not necessarily an elitist like from the people from the eastern part of the state. And he went to Continental Congress in 1775 and voted for independence as one of the representatives from North Carolina. And he served there until about 1781, and he came back here. So he's significant in that. I mean, and like I said, he would be the first person that would say, I was divine providence plucked me from obscurity, and it's not without irony that my name is John Penn, and I became famous for signing something with a name like Penn, wouldn't you be? So,
yeah.
But that's, you know, and he's just one of a number of people that are from here that did things beyond Granville County that made a mark, not just in the United States, but in the world's history. James Webb is a classic example. I mean, when you think about, okay, in their late 50s and early 60s, the Russians were beating our tails in the space race. The first nation to put a man in space, put something, an object on the moon to successfully launch a spacecraft. And we needed somebody to rectify that situation. Well, what would you need? You would need somebody that probably had been in the military, that had experience in the aerospace industry, that had run a large government agency before, that had experience with the ability to contract out things, that had the ear and friendship of, say, congressmen and the president, somebody that could go to the president's White House and sit down and say, John, I need $16 million for a new rocket, okay?
Yeah.
And they'd sit down and have a drink. Well, that's all you need with somebody with all those qualifications.
Right.
Where would you go to look for a person like that?
Granville County.
You do, because James E. Webb had run a large government agency before. Yeah. He'd been Secretary of the Treasury. He had been worked with the Sperry Corporation and the Kerr-McGee Corporations, which were large technically oriented things. He had been a Marine officer. He had been a pilot. He had been he was on a friendly basis with practically everybody in Washington, D.C. I talked to his daughter one time. I said, what was it like growing up with somebody like James Webb running NASA? And she goes, well, it's the strangest thing. She goes, he would call sometimes and say, I can't come home tonight for supper. I'm having dinner at the White House. And she was young. She thought everybody's daddy did that sometimes. You know, but that was where she... And where do you go to find someone like that? You come to Granville County and you find James Webb is from here. And he was the guy, I contend, he masterminded the plan and oversaw the plan for the moon, Apollo 11, and landing on the moon. But he did something even more so than that. He created NASA, which for the past half century, or longer, more like 60 years, has been the leading technological and research scientific organization on planet Earth. The things that come out of NASA, everything from artificial hearts to solar panels,
Velcro.
Yeah. The dust buster was invented by NASA so that they could take up soil from the moon. Even freeze dried coffee. Maybe not everything they invented benefited humankind, but I mean, no, I'm not kidding though. But think about that: the things that the pacemaker, the technology, but that came out of NASA. That was all organized. He didn't invent this stuff, but he brought it together. His skill set brought it together. That was somebody from Oxford, North Carolina, that did that.
It's interesting that you said, okay, that somebody that brought that together, that, you know, a personality like that has to be able to do that. To say,
it's unbelievable.
Here's disparate personalities, strong disparate personalities.
Absolutely.
You got to get all these people going in the same direction.
You have to deal with somebody like Wernher von Braun, who was a Nazi
Yeah.
that invented the rocket, the B-2 rocket, that has certain issues with prejudice. Yeah. You've got to deal with his eccentricities. You've got to think. There's a great thing on YouTube where Lyndon Johnson, James Webb, it's an audio of James Webb and Lyndon Johnson discussing the upcoming budget for NASA in, I think, 1966. And Webb has a Granville County. He's talk kind of like, he's got that Virginia accent. Yeah. In him, like the guy that used to be the narrator on The Waltons. I don't know if you don't remember The Waltons.
I wasn't, yeah.
Yeah, but you do. Yeah. All right, yep. Look. Good and Lyndon Johnson has that good old Southern drawl. And you listen to them talk, and you think they sound like two guys from Stovall arguing over the price of a used car. And he said, I got to have $16 million. Jim, I don't know if I can give you $16 million. I can give you $15.5 million. But good gracious, you're breaking me here, man. Yeah. And they're just a couple of good old Southern boys, you know, making a deal.
Yeah. Yeah.
For, you know, landing on the moon.
Yes.
Anyway, it's just, but to your point, it did take, like I said, he didn't invent this stuff, but he was the person that facilitated all.
Yeah, that takes a special person.
It does. It takes a unique person. Like I said, I'm not sure there's anybody else. The Russians didn't have anybody like that. No. Karlov died before they even, in the middle of the space program, and they never had anybody that could kind of do that. And remember, Webb came from, he grew up in the Depression and came from the New Deal. He was a veteran of the Second World War. He was a great believer and had seen what government could do.
Right.
And where it could take you from this level of poverty to this, to the White House.
Right, right.
Anyway, I didn't mean to get off talking about James Webb.
No, this show's all about going off topic.
Yeah.
But you did have a question about Webb.
Yes.
And what has surprised you most that you've learned about the local history?
A couple of things here. First off, I'm surprised at how many people actually care about it. I thought I was the only nerd person that was... When I was in high school, I got interested in this when I was in high school. When I was 16, back in the bicentennial. Or as a friend of mine says, we're rapidly approaching the 50th anniversary of the bicentennial. Exactly. I've actually had somebody utter that phrase to me. I said, well, we'll celebrate that along with the 250th anniversary of the country while we're at it. But no... there are people that I'm surprised how many people do care about history, and I'm pleasantly surprised at how many young people care about history. Now, people, I will tell you, most people who are young don't care about history. It's the nature of who they are. When you are young, you're always thinking about the future. Got to graduate from high school. Got to find a significant other. Got to find my first job. Got to learn how. I have to learn how to drive a car. We have to get married. We have to have kids. We have to We have to get a decent job. We got to buy a house. That's what you spend the first 15 years of your life, from the time you're 10 to say time you're 15 to maybe 30.
Yeah.
And then there's always what I call the three triggers. People accomplish a lot. They get older, and then rather than looking forward all the time, they start to look backwards. And sometimes there's three triggers that do that. The kids grow up and move away from home. Mm-hmm. Their parents pass away. Or they retire. Hmm. And sometimes all three of those significant events happen pretty much close together in a person's life. And then you start to reflect about the past. What have I accomplished? What's next? You know, and people I noticed that never gave a hoot about history when they were 25, all of a sudden they're 55 and they start wandering in the North Carolina room and want to know what happened to so-and-so in their graduating class in 1979 or where the old movie theater they used to go to it used to be and so on and so forth.
Would it be fair to call history an identity question?
Yes, absolutely. Because remember, and I always try to point this out, I love restoring old houses, and I love putting up historical markers, and I don't want to see battlefields get bulldozed over or things like that. But remember, they're only significant. They're just places. They're just wood.
Right.
It's the what you attach to them. I'll give you an example. When I was in art school, I said, you know, what's a masterpiece worth? And they said, well, technically it's worth about $3 or $4. That's, you've got canvas on there, you've got wood, you've got some pigments, but it sells for $35 million because it's a Van Gogh, right?
Yeah.
That is the intangible that is worth $35 million. Literally, it's only worth the paper that it's literally, or canvas that it's painted on.
Right.
And history's a little bit like that. I mean, it loses context sometimes. One of the saddest things is to see an old house in a neighborhood that's completely suburban now that used to be farm and a country, and it's surrounded by Burger Kings and fast food places. You see that a lot in Virginia now with the development in Virginia and a lot of Civil War battlefields. And so it loses significance. But it's what you attach to it. It's the identity that you attach to it that's significant, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, there are things beyond the intrinsic value of something.
History, you're saying that, okay, there comes a point in time where the question is, well, really, who am I? And the answer to that question being, where did I come from? What have I lived?
It is a natural human.
What was I born into?
What were you? It is, most people don't. I thought about it at an earlier age because I don't know why. Just because I don't know. I wasn't as physically active as I should have been growing
you
up.
You developed early.
I'll put it to you this
you
way. No. My mom used to say, if you don't straighten up, you're going to have to go outside and get your head out of that book. Now, if you don't straighten up, you're going to have to go outside and play. And I was like, all right, I'll be better because I want to finish reading this book on World War II. But I mean, no, it's it is a natural human thing to want to know. It's just like seeking divine inspiration or providence or God or whatever you call it. Human beings, whether they realize it or not, my opinion is they seek that. They might not even be aware that they're seeking it. But it's just like history, because history is identity with people who feel like you do, that have similar backgrounds and similar values, similar generations.
Right.
You know, so I think there's a natural tendency for people to be interested. I'm always flabbergasted when people aren't, but I'm reminded not everybody loves it as much as I do.
Hmm. You know. If folks are interested in learning more about the Oxford and Granville County history, where should they go to discover more and find resources online, the museums in the area?
Well, they pretty much need that. When they come to North Carolina, if they don't find it there, they should just give up. No, I'm just kidding. There is a lot. I always tell the next step would be state archives. We are very fortunate in this area because we have two major institutions, the Southern Historical Collection at Chapel Hill and the Rubenstein Library at Duke, that a lot of places don't have, that are just down the road. We also have one of the best state archives of anywhere in the United States, the North Carolina State Archives. North Carolina's not always been progressive over its history in certain aspects, but when it comes to certain things like the Art Museum or, say, the archives, they are one of the nation's leaders in that. That's a template that other institutions and other archives have used. I mean, they were doing this back in the 1800s. So there's that aspect of it. Of course, online, there's more and more put every day online. I have to go back two years ago. There are papers that I wanted to go through, but now they've been put online. There's wills and deeds and things that have been put online. So there's always that. And don't forget this. People forget this sometimes. Talk to the oldest member of your family. If you want to know what Oxford was like in 1970 when the riots were going on, there's still a lot of people around that remember that.
Right.
I mean, one of the things that's been really interesting in my point of view, when I would go to family reunions as a child, there was always the old folks that I'd love to sit around and listen to and hear about what so-and-so happened in the Civil War, what y'all did when this, and who was related to that, and all the rest of that. You know who that person is now? Me. I mean, I've become that person at family reunions. But so don't forget about those people is what I'm saying. Don't forget. Because you think about things. You don't realize how much time goes by sometimes. I'm astonished to think that most people under a certain age don't remember the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
There's no member. I said something about the draft to somebody a few weeks ago. And then I was reminded that there's no military person, somebody serving in the military right now that's ever been drafted.
Yeah.
And they said it's not very windy or anything.
But no, seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, to your point, that is a resource that people don't always think of. You don't think, you know, you don't think of some of the things that happened in your life as being history. A good example of this, a book came out not too long ago about the history of Falls Lake. And I thought, well, good Lord, Falls Lake has reached a point where it's considered history? Yeah. It was built 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And it was quite a contentious issue at the time, and nobody thinks about that when they're riding a ski or fishing in Falls Lake.
Right.
So don't forget those people.
Right.
Can you describe the flags of Granville County and Oxford and their meaning?
Well, basically, the one that everybody sees is the white flag with the four diamonds on it, the four orange diamonds, which is actually from the Granville family, or excuse me, more to the point, the Carteret family.
Okay.
The Carteret family goes way, way back in England, and during the 1600s, during the English Civil War, the Carteret family was loyal to the crown. Well, the crown won. And Charles got his head cut off, but eventually his descendants overcame and reestablished the monarchy over Cromwell. As a reward for that, King Charles II gave out lots of free land that he owned in the what became the United States that he had never saw or had any idea what was. And everybody sold their land except for the Carteret family.
Really?
Later on, the family was given the title of Granville, Lord Granville. Their name is actually John Carter. The Earl of Granville's real name was John Carteret, in much the same fashion that it would be Charles of Windsor. Charles Windsor is his real name, but he was called Prince of Wales or the Duke of Edinburgh or something. You see what I'm going
on. Is this the same name that Carteret County of...
That is correct, yeah. That's interesting that there are two counties in North Carolina named for that family. One's called Carteret, and of course one is Granville. Mm-hmm. And he owned this property, and he decided to go in the real estate business. Again, this section of North Carolina is different from the rest of North Carolina in that this area was owned. You didn't buy property from the colony or from another person. You bought it from Lord Granville.
Right.
You got a grant.
Right.
You know. So, I mean, a lot of people live on property today that are directly, that their ancestors directly bought from Lord Granville.
So you mentioned earlier, talking about how Granville County was larger than it is now. Do you know the actual land difference? Have any idea of?
Well, actually, technically, it all went all the way to the Pacific Ocean, which would have been really interesting to the people that live.
That's one big county.
What they did was they set the borders of the county, but the western border they were not. I told you it was a frontier back then.
Yeah.
And so they did. It was an undefined boundary, but theoretically, it went all the way to till it got to the ocean.
Really.
To
think Granville County had a beach.
Yeah, I know. And it wasn't Carl Lake or Falls Lake either. But the other thing about it, too, is I don't know the actual dimensions. Like I said, it originally it encompassed what is now current Granville, Franklin, Warren, Vance, and it was divided in half in 1763, Granville and Butte County. Butte did not exist but for a few years, and Butte was further divided into Franklin and Warren County, and that was because of the American Revolution. Lord Butte had been George III's tutor, and he was Prime Minister of Great Britain at one point. He was the enemy. It was a little awkward calling it Butte County.
Yeah.
So when they divided it, they named it from one side of it for Benjamin Franklin, the great patriot, and then the other one for Dr. Joseph Warren, who lost his life at the Battle of Bunker Hill.
Right.
I cannot explain. I should know that.
I was wondering.
I know that, I think Granville County is something like 82,000 square acres, something like that. I don't know it like I should, but...
Could you talk more about some of the institutions? You mentioned earlier the two orphanages and the four colleges. Could you talk more about those that used to exist and those that still exist? And
well, of course, you know, you have Masonic Home for Children, Central Children's Home,
which
Central Children's Home was originally set up for African Americans during the days of segregation, and Masonic Home was set up for the white orphans. They are still around. As a matter of fact, they just celebrated, they just celebrate their 150th anniversary for Masonic Home for Children. Of course, a lot of the churches are still here. The oldest physically standing church in Oxford is the Presbyterian church we're in now.
Wow.
Not the congregation,
right?
But the actual building. It's well over 100 years old. I'm trying to think. Some of the things like Horner Military School.
That's on Gilliam Street, right?
Yeah. That's you can see the field down here at Dean Hicks Field.
Mm-hmm.
That was part of the parade ground for Horner Military College.
Okay,
right.
And the Female Baptist College was here. That's on Raleigh Street.
Right.
There's still, I think there's one house along in there that's a remnant of one of the dormitories.
Right.
Mary Potter, of course, that was very influential in the African-American community because it was a private school, two-year high school, and college preparatory school for African Americans. That existed until 1970. Other institutions that come to mind, of course, Camp Butner.
Right.
Was there from January 1942 to January 1947. It was built for one purpose and one purpose only, and that was to train soldiers in the Second World War. It was only there for 5 years. But the community of Butner comes out of that place.
Right.
Butner is the second largest town in Granville County now. They have about 8,200 people living there. Mm. And it did not even become incorporated into the year 2007. Before that, the streetlights, the fire department, the sidewalks, everything was run by the state of North Carolina. Mm. Almost unique in the United States. A government-run city.
I didn't know there were that many people down in Butner.
There are, because, see, it's for the longest, technically, Butner and Creedmoor combined is the largest town in Granville County. But the entire existence of Granville County, except for when Henderson was in Granville County, which became part of Vance County, the largest town has always been Oxford. That is another dynamic that's changing about Granville County. Collectively, Butner Creedmoor is much bigger than Oxford.
Yeah.
But it's, again, because of the growth there. And now, don't forget, with Butner, I mean, a lot of that are institutions.
Yep.
There's something like 6,000 people that are either live in government, state, or federal institutions there, or reside there, or work there.
Right.
What about Hicks? Den Hicks, where the City Hall is now.
That's it. That was actually that was the original Oxford High School before J.F. Right. Webb was. And by the way, J.F. Webb was James E. Webb's father. J.F. Webb was very well known for establishing and consolidating the schools, not integrating, but consolidating the schools in Granville County and really establishing a very good educational system for its time for public schools here. D.N. Hicks was named for the former superintendent, but that was old Oxford High School. When Webb opened it, turned into a junior high school.
Right.
And I think it was, oddly enough, was a ninth grade only for a few years, too. So, I mean, that's other institutions that are not here. Tobacco warehouses.
Right.
They're not here anymore. But, you know, I mean, there's not a functioning, of course, there's no tobacco warehouses anymore with the tobacco ban about 20 years ago. But, I mean, those were things at one point Oxford had some 12 or 14 tobacco warehouses, one of the largest tobacco markets in the world, actually.
Hmm. And why is the city named Oxford?
It was named, there's been some debate about who the actual father of Oxford is. Some people say Thomas Little John. Some people say Samuel Benton. Samuel Benton's plantation, was called Oxford.
Right.
And I think he called it that in homage to one of his ancestors' hometown in England, you know, Oxford.
Right.
You know,
right.
Now, I will say this, Benton is an interesting character because, let me see, I can say this. North Carolina was the most democratic place in the 1760s and 1770s. In other words, there was a select group of people who ran everything.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And one of those people, by example, was Samuel Benton, who was clerk of court, register of deeds, colonel of the local militia, chief judge, justice of the peace, high sheriff, and representative in the colonial legislature, what we call the state house today,
right,
simultaneously, all at once.
Wow.
At one point, things were so bad in Granville County, the candidates for sheriff were determined by your representatives in the colonial assembly. The members of the colonial assembly, when they came up for election, they were determined by who? The sheriff.
Right.
Okay. But no, Benton came up with a very ingenious idea. He owned all this land on this hill. It's now Oxford, in his plantation called Oxford. And he told Granville County, he said, I'll make a deal with you. I'll give you a couple acres of free land. You can have it if you'll build a courthouse here. And so he gave the land for the courthouse. And then what did he do next? He marked off lots. He opened a tavern. He opened an inn. He opened a livery stable. He opened a general store. And became quite wealthy because of his donation of land to Granville County.
Right.
And a lot of people were really opposed to having the courthouse moved here, but there had been no permanent place for the courthouse.
Right.
So the bottom line, it was through the personal financial prowess of Samuel Benton that Oxford is called Oxford.
So if folks are interested in contributing, maybe they have old annuals, yearbooks, whatever.
Oh, gosh.
Or records.
Thanks asking that.
Can they bring them to you, or how does that work?
Yes, thank you so much for bringing that up. As again, I said, particularly with annuals and phone books, you cannot get these things from conventional sources.
Right.
Right.
And, you know, even...
You can't get in touch with, like, I know you and I are talking about, like, Life Touch or one of these companies that makes the yearbooks or whatever.
No, because see, think about it. The aroma of a high school yearbook, particularly if it's one of the old small schools,
right.
Like, you know, like Stovall when it was first through 12th grade, you're only going to have about a run of about 15 books.
Yeah.
Well, over time, how many of those left? And Adam, you know this, some of the more recent ones since, say, 2000,
mm-hmm.
A lot of younger people still have their annuals.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's something we would certainly welcome. What we always do, we send in an acknowledgement. We'll put a placard in the book donated by whoever. That's, we also take financial, you know, a lot of times when someone passes and they're looking to pay homage to a person, they'll donate a book to the North Carolina Room,
right.
And we'll put a placard, say, donated in memory of so-and-so and so-and-so.
Right.
That's that. Newspapers. Okay, got to say this. It's a real anomaly for Granville County. From 1948 to 1968, we're missing almost half of the Oxford Ledgers.
Okay. Wow.
They were not kept by the newspaper. The newspaper had been keeping them, and they needed the space, and they said, well, we know the library's keeping them.
Right.
So they threw theirs out. About the same time, the library was keeping the newspapers, and they were stacking up and
right.
they were taking up space. And then somebody said, well, we know the ledger's keeping them, so
of
we'll
course.
Destroy them. So, and so I've been, that time period, any Oxford ledgers or any newspapers locally would be something we would welcome. But particularly those, I got a call about 12 years ago from somebody who discovered about 800 of them in a barn on their property. And they
really?
Said, come get them. And I was tickled to death.
Man.
But let me tell y'all something. 50-year-old newspapers that have been sitting in a tobacco barn for half a century don't
right.
smell well. They don't smell good. And I loaded up the car and had to drive down the road
yeah.
with my head out the window. But it was, I mean, think of the history that would have been lost if we hadn't had that. So newspapers are something we're interested in, too.
Wow.
And also, just to add one other thing, we do have an oral history project that we, or sporadically, you know, when catch as catch can on that. A lot of people that have memories, the World War II veterans are virtually all gone, but people with memories of the Civil Rights Movement or Vietnam or things like that from that time period are still around. We'd like to get their stories if we could.
Right. Are there any plans to do like a 9/11, like where was I when that happened kind of thing?
You know, Adam, that's a good idea because we're a generation
yeah.
down the road from that.
I mean, there are plenty of young people that were born after that happened. Now.
Oh, what astonishes me is I think about Vietnam was always called the longest war. I was always astonished that during when we were involved in Afghanistan, you could have been born while we were involved in Afghanistan,
mm-hmm.
grown up, joined the United States military.
Yeah.
And be shipped to Afghanistan.
Wow.
You could. I mean, there were people that were 2 or 3 years old that wouldn't have remembered September 11th. That is a great idea because, like I said, as I alluded to earlier, sometimes you don't think of things as being historic because time moves by so fast.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Yeah, I was getting my driver's license that day.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
I always remember it because I was going to work that day and I was like, the day just started off awful, and I was like, how could this day get any worse? And then about 5 minutes later,
right.
it got really worse.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's something, you know, particularly when I see young people now and I have to explain to them what a rotary phone is.
Oh, yeah.
Or something like that.
And you have to let the numbers go back to where they used to go.
I know. I actually had somebody one time. I said, here, see if you can show me how that works. And they were trying to punch it and do all sorts of things. But that's just a generation. That happens. That's like my grandfather being just aghast with horror that I didn't know how to ride a horse.
Hmm.
You know,
I know both my parents kind of grew up with tobacco.
Yeah,
and I've had a lot of my friends that were growing up and have been a part of that culture, and it seems like it's a dying thing. It'd be great if we got some sort of oral history of that too.
You know what? The museum has done a pretty good job
okay.
of that, and Duke University and the Duke Homestead has done a pretty good. We've got a guy named Billy Jurgen here has done a lot of work
on
that. But, right. I mean, it is true because I'm astonished sometimes when I'm talking to people and older people, and I'll use a term like priming tobacco
right.
or barning tobacco, and they look at me like, what
yeah.
are you talking about?
Yeah.
Well, you're talking about tobacco. Was there something about the soil, the red
yeah.
clay, or is that what kind of made this area?
It really did because, again, it was lightning in the bottle, and I pointed this out when I was talking about Camp Butner yesterday. In the southern part of the county, there's a sandy, loamy soil that has high pH. Okay, this
mm-hmm.
is all technical stuff.
Right.
Prior to the Civil War, that land was the worst land in Granville County. Nobody wanted that land. All
yeah.
the nice land was in the northern part of the county. That's why the plantations were there.
Right.
right.
And in the southern part of the county, it was scrubby, red dirt, sandy, loamy soil. Nobody wanted it. The only thing you could do down there was grow corn and turn it into liquor.
Yeah.
Seriously. I mean, it's another unique thing about Granville County is in the southern part of the county was known far and wide for its illegal liquor. What happened was James Buchanan Duke, after the Civil War, cornered the market on cigarettes. Now, cigarettes were a new form of imbibing tobacco. There'd always been pipe and plug tobacco and chewing tobacco and things like that. But cigarettes made it a lot more accessible, and he cornered the market on cigarettes. Eventually, practically any cigarette in the world was made by James B. Duke and Bull Durham in Durham, North Carolina. And lo and behold, just a few miles down the road was the best soil on planet Earth for growing not just tobacco, but what they call flue-cured tobacco or yellow tobacco.
Okay.
This is tobacco that is more geared towards cigarettes. Now, they use it for other things. But because of the flue-cure technique, which is burning tobacco and heating it to a prescribed temperature where the tobacco turns from green to yellow, I mean, when that concept first came out, there were people like Fielding Knott and the Tillys that were selling that stuff for like $6 a pound in the 1800s. I mean, even now, you get a good price of $2.15 per pound of tobacco. So that, as a matter of fact, there was a guy that came here from Australia, and he wanted to start growing tobacco in Australia, and he loaded up a train full of Granville County dirt, sent it to Norfolk, put it on a ship, and took it down to his farm in Australia and was going to make millions or thousands growing tobacco with Granville County dirt because it was the best dirt in the world to grow. And, of course, there are other factors to it like climate, and there were too many eucalyptus trees down there and other things like that. But my point was it came about at the very right time. Now, afterwards, later on in this 20th century progress, you could reconfigure through chemicals and things like that and manipulating the tobacco plant. You could kind of replicate that flue cured that this area was so well known for.
Right.
But there's still a lot of tobacco being grown here. But to answer your question, once again, as that's kind of a theme here, there was something unique about Granville County that facilitated that particular thing.
In a previous lifetime, I did overseas travel. And the vendors that I worked with, I was like, you know, is there anything I can bring from the United States? Without a doubt, it was always, bring us those cigarettes.
Absolutely. I smoked for 30 years. I can't, I helped, I enjoyed smoking cigarettes too, but again, staff times changed. We could smoke at school when I was in high school. We could actually, and a 17-year-old could drive a school bus too. I don't think you can do either one of those.
Different world.
But no, I hope that answers your question. But I'm not surprised to hear that at all. Well, I mean, it was something North Carolina was. It's like steel in Pittsburgh, chips in Silicon Valley, oranges in Florida. Cheese in Wisconsin, wheat in Kansas. It was our thing.
Yeah.
That was what we were known for. And a lot of people made a lot of money off of it. I'm always struck by the fact that when I was a kid growing up, Durham marketed itself as the city of tobacco. Now they market themselves as the city of medicine.
City of medicine.
And I've often wondered if that was a statement in and of itself.
One led to the other.
Yeah.
Well, Alan, before we start wrapping things up, do you have anything else you want to...
You know, we got a couple questions here, you know, that I'm not quite sure how to ask them to you. You know, historians, you know, the whole discipline is one of looking backwards. Do you ever think about the future in terms of, okay, what might be happening here and what might history help us in terms of, okay, the growth and development of Oxford?
I think about it because by nature I'm a conservative person, believe it or not. And, of course, historians, part of the reason I think what motivates people to be historians is they have an affinity to the way things used to be. And they like things better in the good old days than they like now. The music was better in 1979 than it is now.
Of course.
You know, the economy, the camaraderie of family and values that we shared was always so different. It's not like these things nowadays. And you know, and I consciously try to avoid thinking like that. I don't want to be one of those people like my dad that went around saying, I can't believe you listen to that stuff. You call that music. And I have to catch myself because continually I do stuff like that. Having said that, I in recent years, it's a strange thing. Most people, when they're young, they're liberal, and they get older, they get more conservative. Churchill said, if you're not a liberal when you're young, you don't have a heart. If you're not conservative when you're older, you don't have a brain. I've actually done the opposite tack. I feel that I used to be very cynical about the future, but I think things are going in a good, positive direction. It's like this.
Yeah.
Right.
But I changed my mind on that. And I've been encouraged by the fact that people that don't move here or sometimes that didn't grow up here are the people that are most interested in finding out about the history mm-hmm. of a place. They're people that are not invested in this community for generations and generations are sometimes the people that are more likely to go to a commissioner's meeting or to want to improve things or things like that. So I'm
so greater participation.
Yeah, and I'm just saying I'm kind of hopeful on things. There does seem to be a natural human tendency to want to preserve things, and we have the capability to do it more so than we used to, and we do have a unique history here.
Yeah.
So I mean, I hope that answers that question. I don't see it going away. Mm-hmm. I don't see the North Carolina room going away. I don't see the museum going away. Now I know there's a common thing where people don't really appreciate history like they should. Because, you know, I mean, gosh, look at how many old buildings get torn down. Look how many, you know, like I said, old battlefields that get, you know, or old houses or things that, you know, one thing that people are not conscious of, that you might not think of a Pizza Hut or the McDonald's as a historic building, but 50 years from now, it might be a unique thing.
Oh, yeah.
A tobacco barn. Or something like that.
But so, yeah, that was the first McDonald's in North Carolina, in Granville County or something. Or.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I'm saying to you in the sense that, you know, a good example, there's a Shell station in Winston-Salem that's shaped like a shell.
Oh, that is cool.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
They used to be ubiquitous. You'd see them when I was a kid all over the place, little places like that. That's the only one left in America. It's on the National Register of Historic Places. Okay? So think about that a second. I'm not saying it's not within the realm that my mom and dad's ranch house that was built in 1965 might not be on the National Register one day, but think about this. That house is over half a century old.
Wow.
And that when that house was built, a house that was half a century old had been built in 1900. I mean, so think about that. So, I mean, I think that so far as that goes, I think I feel very hopeful for the future. Okay. And particularly when people move here from other places, and it adds to the level of interest, I think. And you would think it might be the opposite effect. They're not from here. They don't care. You know, they're not invested in it. But maybe they are. Some of them are.
Right. Right. Any more questions, Adam?
I think for now I'm probably pretty good. Is there any way people can reach you?
Yeah. You can reach us through the website, the Granville County Library website. GranvilleCountyLibrary.org. It is on our website. We have a section for genealogy. I'm at the North Carolina Room. If I don't retire, I'm at the North Carolina Room on Mondays through Fridays from 9 to 5. I go to lunch between 1 and 2. And on Fridays, I'm there from 2 to 3. Sometimes I'm there on the weekends. I can also be reached at the Granville County Historical Society Museum. I'm also involved in that because I have a little bit of time left to do something, so I figured I'd use it to preserve some more history if I could.
Great. We are grateful for that.
Yeah. Do you think they'll use some of this technology to create like an AI version of you? They can be an assistant.
Everybody needs to do that to create their AI version, see what they look like.
Right.
And see what they
I've been shocked. AI, I saw a demonstration of AI about 6 weeks ago, genealogical demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
AI can read, you know, that script?
Yeah.
Those old handwritings that we talk, they can read that.
Oh, wow.
They can read that. Now, they don't get it right the first time, but they can tweak it. And I was just like, oh, gosh.
And I saw this thing on YouTube where they were doing like digital renderings of Alexandria in Egypt.
Yeah.
Of like looking what was below the surface. Of like based on how much they could, you know, use like
Landsat.
I was like, this is incredible.
It's incredible. And I'll tell you the two, you can key in on AI and you can say, I saw somebody demonstrate this. We want a picture of somebody living in Piedmont, North Carolina that's a farmer in 1840 on a wagon.
Wow.
And you had to tweak it a little bit, you know, but eventually you got that. The Landsat things are really interesting because they've been finding stuff all over like Cancun and in Mexico and places like that. I've often wondered if you could apply it on a local level. And there's also ground penetration radar that can now, it's very expensive, but you can detect changes in the subsoil where someone's buried.
Hmm.
That's been used here in Granville County.
Wow.
Is everything on the Wikipedia entry for Oxford Granville County accurate? Have you looked at those?
Surprisingly accurate. It's not. I mean, it's only as good as the person that wrote the article. Yeah. They have some good information about demographics, about the population. Of course, it's my version of history is different from someone else's version of history. I think they should. It's. I don't know. There's some things that are very important to us right now in history, like say the Civil War or the Second World War or civil rights. I don't know in 30 or 40 years from now those things will be as have the level of interest that
right.
You know. You go back and look 50 years ago and people were interested in the history of tobacco, or they were interested in the revolution, they were interested in different things.
Right.
So, you know.
Cool.
Anyway, guys, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
I really appreciate
Thank you so much, Mark. This has been a terrific conversation. We hope that you will come back.
Oh, I'd love to. You guys seem to ask some good questions, that's for sure.
Thank you.
You have anything you want to say, Adam?
I'm good. Well, I guess we'll see you next history. I don't know. Next era, decade, or...
I will say I'm 63, so I don't know how much longer I'll be doing this, but... I hope we can find a young person or somebody that comes along that would be willing to keep the flame lit, so to speak.
Right. All right. You've heard the charge here from Mark Pace. All you young, up-and-coming historians, you're needed. Thanks again, Mark. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, audience. We are grateful that you're watching the Oxford NC Exchange. We look forward to the next time. Take care.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.